Hello and welcome to a new edition of Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason.
And I'm Peter.
And we have a great show for you today. First, we're going to talk about some changes to the show. And one of the most exciting things is that we have new equipment, and we hope it will improve the sound quality quite a bit. We've also got a new format for the show.
We're going to be a little more interactive. Both of us will be here on most all of the shows. So you get the benefit of the give and take, and two heads are better than one.
Indeed. In addition to both of us interacting with you, we're also going to be focusing on one topic, or one educational piece, rather, per show, instead of two.
In addition to the educational piece each week, we'll have special features to accompany that, which we might include news. We certainly want to include some success stories. We will entertain and answer questions from you, our listeners.
That's right. To submit a question, go to www.promoneytalk.com. You'll find Contact Us link on the right-hand side of the page. Go ahead and click on that, and there'll be a form where you can submit questions to us. Additionally, you can also submit your own success stories, and we may cover them on the air.
One of my goals is to write a book about people's success stories, and there's nothing more powerful than hearing from other people what they've done in their own lives.
Well, in today's show, our topic is going to be how to get good returns and at the same time reduce risk. So, Peter, maybe you can talk to us, first of all, about how we reduce risk in our portfolio.
Well, today's topic really is diversification, which is a topic that we hear mentioned a lot, but today we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of it, the nuts and bolts of diversification, which really does give investors the best of all possible worlds of keeping risk low and at the same time giving better returns over time. Risk is reduced when investors own different kinds of investments at the same time. There's at least four major kinds of investments that we'll get into in a minute. Usually one of them does better than the others in a given time period, in a quarter or a year. So if an investor is too narrowly focused, then the swings in the value of the portfolio are going to be much greater than they would be if they owned a diversified portfolio. So diversification really is owning different kinds of investments, or what we call asset classes.
Can you tell us what you mean by asset classes?
Asset classes is the technical term for different kinds of investments. In the classical sense, there were three main asset classes. Cash, which means interest-bearing accounts like CDs or money market funds. Second asset class was bonds, sometimes referred to as fixed income. And the third asset class is stocks. As time has gone on and the world's gotten to be a bigger place with more going on, most portfolio managers now would include international stocks. And in our portfolios, we include real estate as the fourth type of asset class. So these are the very broadest categories of investments.
So to be properly diversified, what does that mean?
Well, it means that investors need to probably own a little bit of each kind of investment. And the reason being that under different economic scenarios, different kinds of investments do well at different times. It's really impossible to know what's coming up tomorrow or next week or next month, because we may go into a recession, we may have some inflation, we may have higher interest rates, the dollar may sink, all kinds of things going on all the time. And because there are millions of investors out there, the prices of the different investment classes will reflect pretty much everybody's knowledge about what's coming up in the future. So it's impossible to know whether a given asset class is going to go up or down in the short term, in my opinion. Given the fact that we don't know, people need to own a little bit of everything. And over time, that yields good results, and it also keeps the risk way, way down. Every kind of investment has some risk to it. And what we're trying to do is reduce the risk first and foremost.
Get a little bit more specific there, Peter. You say every kind of investment has some risk in it. I know that a lot of people come in who are very risk averse, meaning that they don't like very much risk in their portfolio, and they'll put a lot of their money in bonds. Maybe they put it all in bonds. Isn't that reducing risk?
It does reduce one kind of risk, which is the risk of the value of the portfolio going up and down. But it introduces another risk, which is equally serious in my opinion, and that is the risk of not keeping up with inflation. Mm-hmm. Or giving up a whole lot of return in order to have that marginal sense of safety. So the first idea is that because you can't outguess the markets, it really makes sense to participate in several different types of investments. That reduces the risk and makes sure that you don't miss out on the good things that happen.
Well, you've talked about diversification for managing risk. I would like to get more into each of the asset classes.
Okay.
And some of the sub-asset classes. You mentioned four main pieces. You talked stocks, bonds, cash, and real estate. Let's start with stocks.
All right. Well, stocks are traditionally known as a pretty risky asset class. I think 1 year out of three, they are down historically. And at times, they're down for 5 years in a row or sometimes even 10 years in a row. And that's why we say investors should have a long-term perspective. If they don't, there are other assets that might be appropriate, but stocks are only appropriate if you can stick with them for a while, because even as experts, we don't know when that downturn is going to come. It can be precipitated by a terrorist attack or some other effect that comes out of the blue or out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
So stocks are pretty volatile, but within the stock asset class, we can reduce risk by owning, as I said, U.S. stocks, smaller stocks. We can buy so-called growth stocks, which are known companies that are rapidly growing but might cost more. We can own value stocks, which may or may not be growing quickly, but they're cheap for one reason or another. They're judged to be cheap. We should own some foreign stocks, probably some stocks from emerging markets.
Mm-hmm.
So just buying an S&P 500 index fund or a total market fund doesn't even give you the broad diversification in stocks that I like to see.
So certainly someone who has 20 or 30 stocks predominantly in technology would not be considered a diversified portfolio.
Right. It's really on a continuum. That would be more diversified than owning one or two stocks, but it would be less diversified than owning 20 stocks in 20 different industries. One of the things that people ask commonly is, if I invest in General Electric and Colgate and companies that have a lot of foreign exposure, am I getting that foreign diversification? The best studies I've seen indicate that the foreign diversification comes about and is gained through stocks that are listed on foreign exchanges, that stocks on a given country exchange tend to perform in line with each other. Their price movements are more highly correlated with other stocks in the same country than they are based on where the earnings come from.
I see. So even though Coca-Cola may sell more of their product in, say, South America than North America, because the stock is listed in the United States, it's going to correlate more with U.S. stocks than with South American stocks.
Exactly right.
Bonds. Are there different categories in bonds as well?
There certainly are. There's high-quality bonds, like government bonds, municipal bonds. You can get down into the corporate level. There's blue-chip company bonds. There's riskier company bonds. We call those high-yield bonds or junk bonds sometimes because the credit quality of those companies may not be as high as the blue chips. There are lots and lots of different credit quality ratings of bonds, and you can look those up. Standard & Poor's and others, Moody's, rate
right.
Different bonds. There are also foreign bonds. So you can invest in foreign government bonds, foreign company bonds.
And I'll also add to that,
mm-hmm.
that because bonds have a fixed duration, when you're buying bonds on a market, you can buy bonds that have a long time until they mature or bonds that have a short time until they mature.
So that's the second major classification of bonds. The first, as we discussed, was the credit quality. The second is the duration or in broad terms, the time till it matures. Duration is actually a technical term. And I don't know that we want to get into that today, but a duration is a more sensitive measure of the bond's sensitivity to interest rate changes. Longer-term bonds fluctuate in value more than short-term bonds as interest rates change. So we can diversify by the length of maturity of the bond and by the credit quality. We can go for high-quality bonds with short maturities, which means that we're probably not going to have a whole lot of fluctuation, but we will get the money back sooner, we'll have to reinvest it. The reason that a longer-term bond fluctuates more and actually does have risk, many of them fluctuate quite a lot, is because when you own one of those bonds, you've locked in your return for a long time. So if I've locked in, say, a 4% return for the next 20 years, interest rates go up to 5%, nobody's going to want to pay me full value for my bond because right. they can get 5% somewhere else. So I'm going to have to make up 20 years of interest payments in terms of the price that I sell the bond at. I'm going to have to take a pretty substantial discount. Mm-hmm. Whereas if the bond matures in a year and interest rates rise 1%, it's going to be a relatively small amount to make up.
Okay. So we've talked about, now we've talked about stocks, we've talked about bonds. Let's talk about real estate. Now, I own my home. Don't I have real estate?
Well, you do, and it fluctuates in value also.
Of course, I've noticed that.
It's only gone up, you know, and a lot of people think that will continue forever. I have my doubts. Trees mm-hmm. don't grow to the sky, as we say in the investment business. But we usually don't count the home as part of the portfolio because you need somewhere to live. So we call that a personal use asset. So when we talk about investing in real estate, we're talking about either buying securities, which are like they are actually stocks that are invested in real estate, or you can buy it directly. Some people own a vacation home or a rental or an apartment building and that sort of thing. That's direct investment in real estate. That's fine and good. There's a fair amount of work involved, and it's fairly concentrated. It's not diversified. But by using real estate investment trusts, which are actually stocks that trade on the stock exchange, investors can get a portfolio of commercial real estate that's almost always dividend paying, so they can receive an income stream from it, and they can also participate in appreciation of commercial real estate. Of course, those stocks can also go down. Their value will fluctuate like any other asset.
And the value is based on the value of the underlying holdings.
Yes, and it's interesting that a lot of people think that real estate stocks are going to move a lot like bonds because they have a pretty good dividend rate, usually 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%. And a lot of investors, even professionals, think that when interest rates go up, the value of your real estate stock's going to go down because, again, there are higher competitive interest rates out there. But it turns out that real estate stocks are not highly correlated with bonds, and they're also not highly correlated with stocks. They make an excellent diversifier for portfolios.
Okay. Now, you also talked about cash, and we know that a lot of people like to have cash as a cushion. Some people say they have 6 or 9 months worth of cash on the side in case something happens. But that's not what you're talking about here. You're talking about cash as an investment vehicle. Explain that.
Well, when you hold money in a CD or a money market fund, you're not only keeping it liquid and available, but you're also you're putting part of your portfolio into an asset that doesn't fluctuate. So it really cuts the risk down in the overall portfolio. As I said before, the risk of the kind of risk that you experience in a cash investment is that you don't make very much money on it.
Right.
It doesn't fluctuate, but if you only make 3% instead of 8 or 9%, you're giving up a lot for that safety. There are uses besides just keeping the portfolio risk down for holding cash, and one of them is if interest rates are rising quickly, a money market fund is a great place to be because unlike bonds where the value of the bond goes down when interest rates go up, in a money market fund, they're reinvesting the money every few days. So it's like a very, very short-term bond fund that doesn't take a big hit at all. In fact, according to the accounting rules out there, they don't have to take any hit to the value of the fund at all. They can keep the net asset value, the value of a share, at a dollar all the time, and they can raise the interest rate they're paying on a daily basis, which keeps up within a few days of current market rates. So in a rising interest rate environment, all things being equal, a money market fund is going to be a better place than a bond fund or an individual bond. It's going to have a higher total return because you're not losing principal value.
And if you do have money in your portfolio, it also creates opportunities. If you see a buying opportunity, but you don't want to sell something, it gives you a cushion to be able to purchase that security that you think is going to do well.
That's certainly another use of cash, is the opportunity to be able to move when you want to and take advantage of something that looks outstanding. So it can be a parking place. It can be a source of liquidity for emergencies. It can be a portfolio volatility dampener. And it can be a good place to be in rising interest rates.
Okay, so we've talked about the four major pieces. Are there any other areas that we need to be aware of?
Well, I'm beginning to believe that commodities should be a permanent part of portfolios pretty much.
Commodities. Can you maybe define what a commodity is?
Commodities are things. And the value of things will move differently than in the value of securities a lot of times. Let me try to clarify that. The things we're talking about are things like oil and gas. We're talking about foodstuffs like wheat and corn and the traditional pork bellies. We're talking about raw materials for industrial production like nickel and aluminum and precious and semi-precious metals like gold and silver. We're talking about things that have value and whose value fluctuates. And the value actually goes up when there's more inflation in general. So we're talking about lots of different kinds of commodities here, and I think it's important to be diversified within commodities and not just be in oil and gas or not just be in gold. These are non-productive assets. They don't generate dividends. They don't generate income. They don't grow. They don't have the living value that a company has, but they make a wonderful diversifier. And because of certain political reasons and the way economies work, we're more likely to have inflation than deflation. So over time, commodities have risen in value. In particular, we have to be careful about how we get into them. We need to be diversified, as I said. We should not be leveraged, which is why commodities were considered so dangerous. But recently, some mutual funds have come out that specialize in diversified commodities, and they do it through indexes.
Let me ask you a question, Peter. Typically, how does somebody buy a commodity? In other words, if I think oil is going up, how do I go out and buy oil?
Well, you'd have a couple different choices. You could buy a few oil cans and fill them up with gas and keep them in your garage, and then when the oil crisis hits, you can sell them to your friends, you know, at $5 a gallon. That's probably the hardest way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Secondarily, you can buy stocks that specialize in oil and have oil stocks, reserves within their inventories, like Exxon and so on to some extent.
But if I buy Exxon Mobil stock, that's really not the same as buying a commodity, is it?
It's not quite the same because really you're buying an ongoing company, and the operating value of a company will be different than just buying the pure asset. So you could go to the futures exchange, Chicago Board of Trade or one of the others, and you could put a certain amount of money down for a future delivery of whatever the size of the contract is. It might be 100,000 barrels of oil to be delivered in March, and you buy it at today's price, and then as we get closer to March, if the price goes up, you've taken advantage of that.
I see.
But you control large amounts that way. You put very little down, and you have a lot of risk because you have what we call leverage in that.
So commodities have been traditionally traded on the futures exchange, and they've been traded in a leveraged manner. In other words, you're buying options on the commodity. So that sounds like there's quite a bit of risk.
Tremendous risk. I would not advise that anybody do that because the contracts are always short-term, and the transaction costs, the commissions are high. I'm certainly not recommending it. In fact, a 2% price move can wipe you out or double your money. So in a given day, you can lose everything you put into a futures market. So it really, the way you get involved would be through one of these new mutual funds, which is diversified within commodities, and it doesn't use leverage. And it's kind of we're getting a little deep into this piece, but I think it's a good idea for people to have some idea of how they might invest in commodities since we brought up the subject.
Yeah, I agree.
So we want different kinds of asset classes, these five major asset classes, mixed together. It certainly overall is not going to fluctuate as much as any one of those components would. And the amount that you're going to have in each asset class is going to be determined by several factors. And this is something that, unless you know what you're doing, it's probably a good idea to talk to a professional. But your age will be one factor. As you get older, you don't want so much risk. If somebody's 95 years old, they probably shouldn't have 75% in stocks. They may not be around for another 10 years to recover from losses.
Right.
Different people have different risk preferences. that'll have it'll play a role in building a portfolio and helping decide how much to put into which asset classes.
I see.
And a very important part of it is the individual's goals. Most of us have several goals in our lives, maybe to put the kids through college and then to have some to retire on and maybe some for emergencies. So a portfolio may have several different objectives that are being built into it. So that'll determine how much goes into the different asset classes as well. Some people also shift in and out of asset classes a little bit based on their outlook for the market. And again, this is something that I don't think is a good idea to play with, but if it's used in a sensible manner with some rational foundation for the decisions, there may be something to market timing to some extent. Say, adding a little bit more in an area that looks relatively cheap, maybe trimming back a little bit on an area that looks expensive. With good information and an historical perspective, I think it is possible to take advantage of pricing anomalies, we call them, things that are out of whack compared to their history. But if you don't know the history, you wouldn't have any rational basis for making the decision.
And I'd also like to add that there's some fundamental research that goes into that to help you make the decision. So, Peter, you talked about the four main asset classes and their subclasses, and you also talked about a fifth in commodities. How would a person know if their portfolio is adequately diversified?
Well, there's no simple way to answer the question, except to say that if a person has an advisor, they should discuss each of the four asset classes, the main asset classes, with their advisor, and at least touch on it and have the discussion about those asset classes, the cash investments, the bonds, the stocks, the real estate. Beyond that, there are some simple rules of thumb that people throw around as kind of a starting point. And one of those is for the percentage of stocks in a portfolio, some people like to use the rule 100 minus your age to get the percentage of stocks in the portfolio. So if you're 60 years old, you'd say 100 minus 60, you could have 40% of your portfolio in stocks. It's basically not the answer for everybody, but at least it ensures that as people get older, they have less and less in stocks, which probably is appropriate. But if you figure that people are living to an average age of 77, 78 these days, at age 60, they probably have almost another 20 years. So even at retirement, they have long enough for stocks to probably do well. And if they're a couple, they probably have even a longer period, maybe 25 years.
And this is just taking into consideration age. You talked before about other considerations such as your goals in life and your risk profile. So it's difficult for somebody to be able to adequately determine if they're properly diversified or not.
I think that's true. If they notice that the portfolio is losing money over some short period of time, I'm thinking of a year, for example, if they're uncomfortable, if they have a 10%, 20% loss in a year, probably the portfolio isn't diversified enough, or else it's in the wrong categories.
Okay, well, let me ask another question then. As a professional, when someone comes to see you, how do you determine?
Well, the first thing I look for is to make sure they have all of these different asset classes represented. Then I talk to them about their risk preferences and their goals, and I look at their age. And I try to get a sense of what they'd be comfortable with. My job may be to try to convince them to take a little bit more risk if they're too cautious, because they're going to be missing out, especially if they're younger. Missing out on 3 or 4 extra percent a year is going to add up over the years. But we have discussions about a lot of different things before we come to a final resolution on a portfolio. We talk about each different asset class. We talk about how they work in different economic scenarios. And so I wish I could give you a simple answer, but I think that it's something that it takes time to get familiar with, but probably most people should own a little bit, at least a little bit, in each of the four asset classes. And by starting there, they can get comfortable with or begin to understand how all of the different asset classes work, and they may shift over time. Also, there are some tools that the public can use on the internet. I think Vanguard has some tools, Morningstar does. Most of these tools are oriented towards the retirement planning, but that's what you want anyway. You want this long-term perspective, and they'll give you some idea of the variability of the portfolio over time. And some of them will show the best-case scenario, the worst-case scenario, and the likely scenario in the middle. Another one is financialengines.com, a very thorough website put together by Bill Sharp, who's a Nobel Prize-winning economist from Stanford, who helped build the foundations of modern portfolio theory, which is what we're talking about here, trying to build portfolios that give you the best results with the least amount of volatility.
So all this sounds good. We're talking about decreasing risk, meaning protecting your money. We're talking about being able to participate in upswings in the markets, the various markets, whether it be bonds or stocks or real estate. But in practice, how does that work? In other words, it sounds great as a theory, but over 10, 15, 20 years using this strategy, will people really do as well as the markets as a whole or even better than the markets and reduce risk? Has it happened?
Absolutely. I don't have it in front of me, but there was a study by Baylor, Beal, and Kaiser here in the Bay Area a number of years ago where they showed that the returns in the different asset classes year by year, and looking at the pattern, you couldn't tell from one year to the next if stocks did well one year, whether they'd do well the next year or not, or if bonds did well one year, if they were going to do well the next year. So it was very hard. The top performing asset class jumped around from year to year. But the people who owned all of them did almost as well as the best of them, but they had much, much lower swings in the value of their portfolio. And in our own experience working with clients, we've made very good returns, something north of 10% for retired folks over the last 10 years, and our worst years were only down 1% or 2%. What I want to emphasize is not the absolute numbers, but the idea that the swings in the portfolios have been very, very low, and yet the returns have been very good.
So we're really talking about maybe as close to a sure thing as you can find in the investment world, and that is you're saying that if you diversify well and you diversify well over a long period of time, you're going to do well in the market.
I like that phrase, as close to a sure thing as you can find. I think that's exactly what we're talking about. And I think a good financial planner, is probably the only person who has the sure thing that actually is going to pay off. And this is the sure thing.
Peter, if you were going to give us one word of advice, what would it be?
I'd encourage people to consider diversification, to learn more about the asset classes that they don't feel comfortable with yet, and to begin to stretch beyond the boundaries where they've been. Whether they do it on their own and learn about it on their own or they seek professional advice, I encourage them to learn more and to be sure that they're widely diversified. Don't let other people scare you off. Look for the facts. Learn about it. Study it. I think when you know more and you see how it all works together, that your comfort level will grow and you'll wonder why you were taking so much risk before you diversified.
Now, if anybody has any questions about the show or any questions on the topic that we've covered, please go to our website, www.promoneytalk.com, and feel free to write us, and we may answer your questions on the air next week's show. Additionally, we're looking for success stories, so if you or someone you know has a great financial success story, again, please email us. Hope you enjoyed the show today. I'm Jason.
And I'm Peter.
And please join us again next week for Pro Money Talk. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.